This is Radio Freethinker, episode 87.
Hey, I can't find nothing on the radio. You'll turn to that station.
Hello and welcome to Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and of course also on VXCFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
This is Chloe, member of UBC Freethinkers.
And this is Daniel, president of the UBC Freethinkers.
You know, I'm so excited about tonight. Tonight, for political junkies, is one of the most exciting nights in the world. The American election. It's so much better than a Canadian election, which we talked about before the show. It's like watching a car crash, where the Canadian election's like being in the car crash. You know, there's that sort of, how bad are they going to screw things up? And it's really, really, really exciting. So that's what I'm doing today. What are you guys doing?
Well, don't get too excited. Later on in this show, we have an interview with Marcy McDonald, who wrote The Armageddon Factor, which is about the rise of the Christian right here in Canada. So, you know, go but for the grace of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, do we.
Well, and that's my whole point. Watching the American election, they got the Tea Party. They're really screwed up. And it's funny because it's them. But when it's us, like with the Armageddon Factor in Canada, that's not funny anymore. That's just scary.
Yeah, but as Trudeau said, if you're a mouse living next to an elephant, whatever the elephant does is going to matter a lot.
That wasn't Trudeau. That was
totally Trudeau.
That was Pearson.
Unless high school history lied to me.
No, it wasn't, because Pearson said that long before Trudeau did.
He is our resident historian, so we'll allow him to. That's true.
I'll give you this.
It's got to be true.
I'll fact check later.
Well,
more importantly, the mouse is selling a great deal of things to the elephant, which is really the issue at hand, I think.
Fine, whatever. Who cares? It's a mouse. Doesn't matter. But we got a fantastic show today. Top of the list for us to discuss is ourselves, CITR. We actually mentioned a couple of weeks ago, CITR was featured in an article in the UBC, the campus newspaper here, and we mentioned it because there were pictures of us in it.
So. Well, and of course, that's the important thing.
Well, yeah, we're very handsome.
But wasn't at the heart of it something else more? Community, college, sort of?
Well, you see, there was an editorial in there that was pretty critical of CITR. And, you know, as we're proud contributors, we wanted to discuss some of this. And so we invited our station manager, Brenda Gruno.
Hi, Brenda.
Hi.
And Brenda's going to help us understand maybe some of the criticisms that have been lobbed at CITR. I guess the top of that list is that this station is not living up to the community campus title that we have for ourselves. Is that,
well,
would you say that's accurate?
Brenda, are you a student here?
No, I'm not.
Should everyone who works at CITR be a student?
I don't think so. I think paid staff are important to the stability of an organization, and we're essentially a not-for-profit on campus, and we're licensed as a campus-based community radio station under the CRTC. So that's the policy framework that we survive within. And so our job is to serve all our listeners, and including UBC students, and that means that our airwaves go throughout Vancouver. So we're essentially spreading the good news of UBC to people beyond campus.
From what I understand in the editorial, they sort of complained that it was supposed to be a campus radio involving only campus people, but you said it's a campus-centered community radio. So that means although we're centered here in UBC, our charter is to serve the greater community.
It is true. Now, if you read our constitution and bylaws, it very explicitly does it say that we're supposed to be serving the UBC community as well as the rest. So UBC is our prime target, but it doesn't mean that we'll close our doors to anyone else.
So for listeners that might not know, in what ways does CITR serve the UBC community?
Well, the first thing is that we have a FM station, and that's a very rare thing. It's hard to get a radio station, and as such, we offer content, locally focused content, to UBC students and beyond. We run free advertising for student and campus events. We're very keen to cover local arts and culture and news stories that are happening on campus that are specific to students. And so we definitely want to cover what's going on around us and offer free advertising for what's going on. And then we also offer free broadcast training to people and the opportunity for students and other people to have shows on air.
Well, some of the specific issues raised by the editorial, for example, mentioned that only 15% of the 80 shows that are produced on CITR are made by students. Now, that seems pretty low. What's your response to that?
I would say that 15% is not our desired place to be, and that we work nonstop to try and engage students on campus, and it's really hard, especially since students go to their faculties and then disappear, and there's 300 groups, clubs on campus, plus every other faculty association and whatever, all trying to get students involved. So there's a lot of competition for to get volunteers and to engage people. So there's just so many messages coming at students that they really have to pick their interests and choose. So I'd say we've been working and talking a lot about how we can engage students better and how we can raise that money, and we're working at it.
So this might be the kind of thing where, you know, you get a voter turnout and it's very, very low, but it's not like you're refusing students who come up with valid shows, and you're continually trying to sort of get out the voter, get people out to produce. But it's just there's a lot of hands pulling at students almost all the time.
Students are busy people. It's not always easy for them to have a radio show, believe me.
And we recruit over 150 student members each year, and a lot of them go through training and then disappear. So there hasn't been a problem with students wanting to get on air and not being able to, and that was one of the criticisms in the article, was that community members are taking up all the airtime and students can't get on. And that's a complete falsehood, and as soon as it gets to the point where students can't get on air because community members are there, then we will make changes to our program schedule.
Well, you know, it's important to point out that back when Elon was on the show, we got an email from CITR asking our club if we wanted to do something on the radio. And we jumped at the opportunity, and that's how this show got started. You, Don, me, Elon, and Rob, and Daniel was there as well. And now, you know, me and Don are alumnus, but Chloe and Daniel are both students. Daniel's running the club now. Which is, you know, I mean, obviously he's dividing a lot of his time. I'm sure that his schoolwork is absolutely suffering terribly. But,
yeah,
you know, we're making quite the effort on this show to have a good student content at UBC.
I think that's an important balance, too, because you two basically plain just have more time than Dan and I do because we're dealing with school.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the fact that you guys are here to sort of run it and keep tabs on us is actually quite nice.
Keep tabs on you, yeah. You have telescreens installed in your house.
Yeah.
So we talked about the percentage of students doing shows. What about, you mentioned how you're not a student.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any student campus run radio stations in Canada? Do students ever run a campus radio station?
No. No, I don't think so. There's a few campus instructional stations where it's only students on the air, but they follow more commercial formats because they're teaching people how to be broadcasters, and it's all part of their coursework, so it's also very structured. So it's every other... I sent an email to campus and community stations across Canada, and they ranged anywhere from 11% to 50%, but no one was higher than 50. And all staff are pretty much permanent staff, non-students, but where we actually excel compared to the pack is that we have a student executive as part of our governance model, and they are actually my bosses. So we've got a board of directors and then a team of 18 engaged students who actually make decisions about how the station is run. So even though...
Look, let me get this straight.
Yes.
So you don't actually control the station. You just run the station for students who are actually the board of governors.
Yeah, there's a student executive and then also... a board of directors. Students have representation. The AMS has reps on our board. Students have reps on our board. We've got a couple faculty members on our board and a couple community members on our board. So essentially the board is UBC controlled, right? And then the student executive deal with the day-to-day operations and the board manages senior staff and finances and fundraising.
There was one other point that was mentioned, and that is there's going to be a dollar raise to student fees. And the editorial was very critical of this. How is this money going to be used to improve CITR?
Mm-hmm. Well, we wanted to... we've been talking a lot about offering a DJ training program, which is not DJ broadcasting training program. It's DJ beat matching, club DJing, music mixing program. So that's been, we've been getting a lot of student members who are really excited about learning this, but we don't have the resources to offer a training program for DJs, and we're very well equipped to offer this. We just don't have the time and the money to offer this. So we thought this is a great way we can be part of the referendum, increase our budget, but then also give back something new and exciting that students are asking for, and then that will also increase our student engagement.
Excellent. Well, I think that you know, we've answered a few questions here that were perhaps raised in the editorial, and CITR also had an editorial that was published a week or so later that basically said what we've just been saying, but you know, it's better when it's on radio. Anyway, well, Brenda, thanks for joining us to help us learn more about how CITR really works.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to debate the UBC.
Excellent.
Excellent.
Yes. Well, why don't we go to a commercial break, and we'll be back with some more on Radio Freethinker.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Hi-ya. You're listening to C.
Ooh, yeah.
I.
Hi-ya.
T.
Hi-ya.
R.
Woo-hoo.
101.9 Vancouver.
God damn it, baby. No, I ain't lying to you. I'm only gonna tell you one time. Hi-ya.
A groin-grabbingly great station.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Techs, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl, and The Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker here on CITR. So, Dawn, we've been talking for a while now about mummies and cancer, and oddly enough, the SGU...
Well, you know, it's always funny, right? Because we had this mummy story like about 3 weeks ago, and we kept putting it off because we had more content. And every time we start to do a story, I swear, the SGU must listen to our podcast. And then they do on their show the same thing. And this time it just got mixed around. No, I saw this study that was about cancer in the ancient world. And, you know, I'm always a little dodgy whenever they try and make claims. So I went and I looked at the study itself, and the study actually seemed quite good. I was quite impressed, and was gonna mention that. There was another study I'd seen, which we might talk about on another show, that I thought was kind of poorly done. Then the SGU comes out, and they just slam this study, and I'm going, what? How can they slam? It was a relatively good study. I went through it, you know, and then I did a bit of research into what the SGU did, and I think they largely based their comments both on the press media and one of the author's comments about the study, which, having read that, bizarrely enough, is almost as if she didn't really even read her own study. I mean, one of the claims that she had made and the SGU had commented on is that all cancers are based on man-made chemicals, and that they were, and this isn't exactly 100% accurate the way they stated it, but essentially one of the doctors in the study had stated, not in the study, but in an interview, that there were no cancers in the ancient world, which is ironic because...
Wait, so... She said that, but that's not what the paper says.
That's not
what you're saying.
And it's ironic because when you read the paper, right? I mean, they mentioned various cases of cancer in the ancient world, right? There was Chilean mummies where they had some cancer. There's been at least one diagnosed case of cancer in the mummies themselves. They also did an assessment of ancient medical text literature, right? And they had the Greeks, the Romans, the Egyptians all had treatments for cancer.
Was
right?
It even the word was coined by Hippocrates?
Exactly.
Yeah. So.
So I'm sitting there and I'm going, well, okay, I'm going to go through the study. And the SGU really butchered the study because the study itself was actually quite good. I mean, it made a claim that there's a lot more cancer cases today than there were in the ancient society. And they said one of the possible mechanisms was there's a lot of carcinogens in our society that just didn't exist back in the olden days. And that made some sense, right? But even based on their own assessment, there were still a lot of cancer cases back then, at least about 25% as many then as we have now. But the SGU just didn't seem to look at that. And that was one thing I thought was kind of funny. But the author, this Dr. Davis, like I say, she was making comments that had nothing to do with her own study. So I kind of understand why the SGU jumped on this study. But at the same time, if they actually read the study, they would have found that it was actually much, much better than one of the authors led it out to believe.
Interesting. Well, I guess when they come here in Vancouver on the 20th, you'll have some interesting questions for them.
Well, you know, I think this is starting to be one of those grudge match things, which is who's going to win, the RFT or SGU?
Mm-hmm.
Although there was...
We're the scrappy upstart.
There was one thing that Steve Novella had mentioned in his blog that I'm actually kind of curious to know what you guys said. He said in there that... it is inherently a weak form of evidence. The absence of evidence is an inherently weak form of evidence on which to base a conclusion. Now, what this study had done is that it said, well, back in the ancient times, there were less incidences of cancer. But isn't that called a positive correlation? I mean, I understand an absence of evidence would be that. But again, they never actually said there was no evidence. They actually said there was some evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think his criticism that in this particular type of a study that's comparing the prevalence of something over time, that the absence of a lot of evidence in ancient times is bad evidence, or is it just good evidence?
Well, I mean, anytime you're trying to infer things about the past, you have to be very careful what you consider evidence. I mean, keep in mind that there are a couple areas where you have meticulous records. The Romans were quite good at this sort of thing, ancient Chinese dynasties as well. But in some cases, what you're doing is you're often looking at a lot of what is essentially circumstantial evidence and then inferring based on that. You go, okay, well, there's 8 aqueducts in this city. We can assume then that they were a very clean people. That kind of thing. So, I mean, maybe in that regard, he's onto something. But at the same time, you also got to remember that not everything is going to be reported as well. So if they report, say, X amount of cancer instances in the Middle Ages or in the ancient world, that you might actually be able to multiply that number a bit just because people are going to be stupid. They're not going to know what cancer is.
I think the way you need to look at this is that it has some interesting findings. I wouldn't necessarily put them down as fact yet. But more study should be done. It shouldn't be outright dismissed.
Actually.
Nothing in their methodology makes it an absolutely horrible. It's just more evidence would definitely raise the likelihood of it being right.
Well, and that was one of the things that I liked about this study. When I read the study independent of everything else, was, you know, there was the thing about, well, you know, people live longer now than they did back then. And the study said, yes, well, we've kind of accommodated that because there are certain kind of cancers that affect the young adults and children, that type of thing, right? But I think the one weakness I did find in this, because it was kind of a meta study, is it was low numbers. I mean, even though there were actually lots of, there's like thousands of mummies involved and that type of thing, but I actually looked at some of the cancer rates, and the most prevalent form of cancer in young adults, I can't quite remember, it's kind of bone cancer, but it happens to about 5 people in a million.
Hmm. This is now, not in the ancient world.
This is now, okay. Right? And even we just use that number, that would mean if you had 1,000 mummies, that would be less than one case, right? Hmm. Actually, I think it turned out to be 0.1 case, right? So again, even though there were a lot of mummies involved, because a lot of these things are really, really rare, the numbers are still dubious. Yeah. So I gave a credit to that.
Yeah, even if the cancer was like a 1 in 1,000 rate, if you had 1,000 mummies and there was one mummy with that cancer, that still doesn't tell you much just because it's such a small number. It could be noise rather than true evidence.
Exactly. Well, speaking of true evidence, did you guys know that the Saskatchewan Science Center is haunted?
Dead silence.
I guess not. Well, apparently it is. That's according to a recent blog entry on the center's website. And this entry, I mean, it is chock full of excellent demonstrations of critical thinking, like this one, and I'm going to quote it here. There is a lot of stuff about our world that we don't know about and don't understand. So who knows? Besides, who doesn't love a good ghost story? Well, that's fantastic. Let's teach kids the logical fallacy of we don't know, so whatever.
Well, you know, anyone who's ever watched Discovery Channel will get this all the time, right? I mean, I was looking at a bunch of postings on the internet for Discovery Channel thing about, you know, Cain and Abel. Is it a true story? What's the plausibility of Noah? You know, those kind of things. And you're going, you know, it's you're trying to appeal to the masses. Yeah. And I can understand. I mean, we live in a society that kind of discourages, you know, scientific inquiry. Going to the museum is a boring thing, right? So I can appreciate them trying to have this hook. But at the same time, I mean,
this is such a lame hook, though. Like, I mean, it is so poorly written, and it's so poorly disguised to be this, like, stupid Halloween thing. And they got, like, fake spider webs and plastic skulls that look like they belong from the Pirates of the Caribbean or something. I mean, the whole point of a science center is it's supposed to instill an understanding of science and, you know, critical thinking to young people, not bore them with, like, carnival-style haunted houses. And, I mean, this blog post just absolutely exemplifies all the bad logical fallacies that go along with ghost stories. You got the whole, you know, logical fallacy ad ignorantium. You know, just because something is not known doesn't imply that it's supernatural.
I didn't know that.
Really?
You know, actually, you know, and it's funny too, because there is a missed opportunity here. Because, I mean, even if they wanted to play off the Halloween thing, right, which is kind of spooky, but, I mean, it's also dress-up. So you could have had astronauts and, you know, science. I mean, you could have played up that aspect of it. I mean, it is a science center, right?
Yeah, well, they could have a party instead of ghosts.
Yeah, you know, and so instead of having skulls and all that up there, you had spaceships or, you know.
Or if they want to cash in on the Halloween thing, do something about, like, the science of fear. Explain why we're afraid of the dark. Explain why we have these emotional reactions. Talk about or talk about ghosts and explain why they're, you know, not, there's no evidence for them. Explain how you can understand these faulty arguments. But again, they go with this sort of anecdotal, kind of dumb, lame approach to things, and they're like, oh yeah, well, the building's really old, and sometimes I hear things, and the lights flicker occasionally.
Well, you know, I come from the prairies, so I have to excuse them for a bit, because anyone who's been to Saskatchewan knows it's very flat, right? And I think that might lead to a lack of imagination. So maybe nice. They were just sitting there and they were looking for miles and miles and miles and miles at nothing and said, I got nothing.
Yeah.
Except ghosts.
Well, anyway, I just think it's garbage, and I think the Science Center should be ashamed of themselves.
Shame.
Let's go to a commercial break. When we come back, we'll have our interview with Marcy McDonald, who is the author of The Armageddon Factor. And it's very frightening. Okay. They should have talked about that at the Science Center, The Armageddon
exactly.
Factor.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables.
I got the beat.
I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite! Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Joining us now is journalist and author, winner of 8 Gold National Magazine Awards, and author of the bestseller, The Armageddon Factor, The Rise of Christian Nationalism in Canada, Marcy MacDonald. Marcy, welcome to Radio Free Thinker.
Thanks so much.
So, The Armageddon Factor is about the rise of Christian nationalism in Canada. What motivated you to write about this?
Well, when I returned to Canada from being McLean's Washington bureau chief in Washington and later writing for U.S. News and World Report down there, I heard the same sort of rhetoric that I'd heard in the States during the rise of the Moral Majority and later the Christian Coalition, the same sort of shrillness and intolerance that had not been part of the Canadian public dialogue when I left the country. And it was at the same time as the same-sex marriage debate was beginning in Canada, and I began to notice an American style in the new evangelical leaders that were emerging here, a kind of stridency and anxiousness to use wedge issues to divide the population. And soon after, Stephen Harper was elected in 2006 with the support of the same community, some of the most strident leaders, including Charles McVitie, who's often in the press, were campaigning for Harper. And so it seemed to me that something was happening here. And indeed, when I looked into developments in Ottawa, these organizations that had been essentially defeated in the same-sex marriage vote in Parliament, they lost their fight to stop the legalization, were then putting down organizational roots, which reminded me of 30 years ago in Washington. And I felt it wasn't being covered by the mainstream media, and I had the luxury of time as a freelancer here to look into it. And it's been a fascinating journey.
One of the taglines for your book is an urgent wake-up call for Canadians who think that this country is immune from the righteous brand of Christian nationalism that has bitterly divided and weakened the United States. Does this mean that you're a firebrand atheist warning Canada about church state separation?
Well, in the first place, I'm not actually an atheist, and I didn't really think my beliefs were relevant in the book, but then I began to realize that because most of the books about the U.S. religious right had been written by celebrity atheists like Christopher Hitchens or Richard Dawkins, that it was only fair that I own up to the fact that I consider myself a Christian. I just don't consider myself a born-again Christian, and many of the people that I write about don't consider me a Christian because I'm just a wishy-washy, mainline liberal Christian. But that issue of faith became important because a lot of people have tried to characterize the book as an attack on faith or people of faith having a role in the public square. I'm not doing that, although I do in the end come out indirectly to suggest that it's a secular government, a separation of church and state, which we don't have constitutionally mandated in this country, that is actually going to preserve religious freedom for everybody.
And you mentioned a bit of the criticism. What has the response largely been from the public about the book?
The public has been very supportive, but specific groups, some in the evangelical community and some with very close ties to the current government, have led the charge. And what's been interesting to me is that when I wrote about many of these conservative Christian activists organizing new religious right in this country, they kept saying, well, we're 30 years behind the States. We've got a lot of catching up to do. And I had no reason to quibble with that time frame. After all, it was in the late 70s that the moral majority was formed and really active in the 80s, putting Reagan into power and his agenda forward. But I began to wonder, after the criticism that I was hearing here, if in fact we hadn't sped up the time frame, because 30 years after the moral majority, American dialogue is so polarized, and we're going to see that with the midterm election results. And we saw it in the campaign, we're going to see it tonight. And I think that the kind of vitriol that I had aimed at me in the book suffered from almost makes one wonder if we're not much closer to Tea Party time here in Canada than we think. It's there are real attempts to polarize the dialogue here.
Is it an effort to polarize, or do they think that perhaps you're misquoting them or misrepresenting them?
I've not been accused of misquoting or misrepresenting you. I sort of went to exaggerated pains not to caricature communities, because that was their complaint against the media, that they were always turned into laughingstock. So I wanted people to be able to explain their faith in their own words. It meant that the book was not as cleverly written as it might have been, or maybe as amusing a read, but it was important to me to just do a straight reporting job. No, I think some people feel that they would have liked to have some of the organization and some of the connecting of the dots that the book does, which cumulatively shows a kind of power and influence that most people did not see. I think that's something the government certainly and some of these organizers would prefer to have kept to themselves.
Well, let's talk a bit about the conservative government. How closely connected are they to the Christian right?
Well, it's part, the Christian right is part of Stephen Harper's party-building strategy. He enunciated it way back in 2003 in a speech he made to a group called Civitas, in which he announced that he was then leader of the Canadian Alliance, that henceforth the party would be reaching out not just to economic conservatives, which is his natural constituency, but to social and religious conservatives, and he would be crafting policies that would appeal across faith and party lines. And if you watch what he has done coming to office and in the 4 years in office, it very much fits into that line. So he realized that social conservative policies would appeal to the new immigrant ethnic groups in Canada, many of whom had values that were more in line with his old Reform Party base than with some of the moves that the Liberals were then suggesting, including same-sex marriage. So we have seen that a good chunk of the immigrant and ethnic vote has moved from the Liberal Party to the Conservative Party, 18% according to one McGill study in the 2008 election. So he's been very canny in crafting policies that would appeal not just, that would appeal to this constituency, but also have a wider resonance.
Is he an honest supporter of the movement, or is he being a shrewd politician?
Well, I would say he's being a very shrewd politician. I would never pretend to know the mind of Stephen Harper, but he was never known back in the Reform Party as part of these the social and religious conservative caucus. In fact, many in that community didn't particularly trust him, which is why perhaps he made such an overt series of gestures to placate them. But it's been an uneven courtship. Sometimes he'll be going overboard with policies, and at other points he'll be throwing them over just before an election. So it's been a somewhat rocky relationship for him. However, the thought in the Conservative Party is that social and religious conservatives have no other place to put their votes.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned how this is a nationalist Canadian movement and not an invasion of American values. How is this Christian right uniquely Canadian?
Well, the Christian right in Canada is uniquely Canadian, partly by the fact that we are a much more Catholic country than in the United States. Something like 42% of Canadians consider them Catholics, whereas the number is much smaller in the States, and there's a much higher percentage of evangelicals in the States, whereas here the evangelical population would amount to probably 10 to 15%. But when I write about Christian nationalists, I'm writing about a tiny sliver of these conservative Christian organizers and organizations that I detail in the book. And they're particularly motivated by an idea that Canada has a unique role to play in the end times, and it's a role that was prophesied in the Old Testament in Psalm 72, verse 8, our national motto, and he shall have dominion from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. And they believe that though this was written thousands and thousands of years ago, before the New World was discovered, before the birth of Jesus of Nazareth, if one believes in such a figure, that this was a direct depiction of Canadian geography, and it prophesied the fact that Canada would play a role in the end times. And so they believe that there's an urgency, that the end times are indeed coming, and they're very, their websites are festooned with maple leaves. They have a very patriotic ring in their rhetoric, and there's an urgency in their message that Canada must do away with such policies as same-sex marriage and having no hindrance to abortion in order to assume this prophetic role in the end times.
You mentioned that the majority of the religious in Canada are Catholic. Does that give the religious right movement in Canada a different goal or different ideas than their American counterparts?
Well, it gives a different cast to the movement that I refer to as a burgeoning religious right here, because there's not a homogeneity as there would be in the States, where most of the religious right would refer to evangelicals, who represent about 30% of the population.
And Canada, you mentioned before, Canada has different laws regarding church separation. How does that influence the message of the Christian right here?
Well, we don't actually have any laws at all. In the United States, there's a constitutional amendment mandating the separation of church and state. And it's a bit of a paradox because, of course, when we think of American politics, we think of it rife with religious rhetoric. And certainly during George W. Bush's presidency and in the days since with the Tea Party movement, particularly Glenn Beck's rallies and recent pronouncements. Here we don't have any constitutional amendment or any such legal strictures prohibiting church and state melding, and we have an odd history. We have had premiers of provinces who were preachers, that this would never happen in the States, who were radio preachers on Sunday. I'm thinking here of William Aberhart and his successor Ernest Manning in Alberta, and yet were premiers for many, many years of their provinces. So, and we also had the example of Quebec, which climaxed under Maurice Duplessis in the 50s and very early 60s, when he ran a province, Quebec, virtually as dictated by the Roman Catholic Church, which chose movies, set down morality codes, ran all the schools and hospitals. What we saw then in the 60s was the Quiet Revolution and the backlash against that, so that today Quebec is the most secular province of Canada. So we have a very uneasy minuet of, in our history between church and state, but there seems to be a national consensus right now that we do not want too much religion in our politics. What's interesting in the States is that in 2004, the Pew Forum asked conservative Americans, conservative Republicans, what proportion or how much they felt religion should play a role in politics. And at that point, 30% of conservative Americans felt there was too much religion in politics. After George Bush's second term in 2008, 50% felt that religion had become too prominent in American politics. So that that's an interesting backlash in that country as an example to us.
And obviously in Canada, our technical head of state is also the head of the Anglican Church. Does that influence the Christian right movement in Canada in any ways?
I think not at all. Among most evangelicals, the Anglicans are considered not saved, not born again, not part of their movement unless they're evangelical Anglicans, charismatic Anglicans. Mm-hmm. So that, and I think that most people think that they think of the Queen in a different context, not a religious context.
Interesting. So tell us about the theocons' attack on secularism. What do they want to see? What is their perfect government supposed to look like?
I don't really know what their perfect government would look like. There are a very small handful among the group that I call Christian nationalists, who say that in the long term they would be in favor of an officially Christian Canada. Some would call it a theocracy, certainly governed by and for Christians and according to biblical principles. And I asked one gentleman who runs a website called ChristianGovernment.ca. I think it's now updated to be ChristianGovernance.ca. Would that include these biblical precepts? Include stoning of homosexuals and adulterers, and even people who go to fortune tellers, as spelled out in the Book of Leviticus, and as also spelled out in the ultimate Christian Reconstructionist in recent times, a scholar in the States called Rufus J. Rushdoony. And he said, well, eventually, one would ease into it slowly. One would wait until the entire country was Christian so that everybody knew the game, everybody knew what the rules were, and then eventually, yes, biblical punishment would be part of it. But I have to emphasize that this is a very small slice, a very small sliver. The most interesting thing is that the gentleman I'm quoting is an executive assistant to a conservative MP on Parliament Hill. So it's not just a lone voice in the wilderness.
Now, Harper hasn't seemed very concerned to appoint a number of fundamentalists into key positions. Gary Goodyear, for example. Is he not concerned that somebody like Goodyear could embarrass him the way that Stockwell Day was embarrassed as a creationist?
Well, it seems not. In fact, when Goodyear's views were sought out on science because of the massive cutbacks to scientific research budgets that were going on, and he was asked what he felt about evolution, his answer, as you probably remember, was, you shouldn't ask about my religion. Well, actually, the reporter hadn't asked about his religion. He is an evangelical who comes from southwestern Ontario, and his church is part of a community that might well embrace creationism, but it was not known. It was a question in the minds of the scientific community about whether or not this had an effect. So it made headlines at the time, as you'll remember, and then he was later defended by another conservative member of parliament who questioned the whole nature of evolution in a speech on the floor of the House, and who said that if Darwin were alive today, his beliefs and writings would be questioned. There was no proof of that, which is, I think, in the scientific community, absolutely not true. And what we had was not Harper distancing himself from these pronouncements, but openly supporting Goodyear, making sure he stood with him at the next funding pronouncements, and seeing the weight of the government ranks close around him, and the media was blamed for being unfair and trying to embarrass Christians. So there's a completely different view from this government than there has been before.
Wow. Well, Marcy, thanks for talking with us. Perhaps the most difficult question, what can fans of secularism do to help the situation in Canada?
Well, it's not up to me to offer any answers, just as I keep defending my book as not a polemic, merely a reporting job. I sort of laid out the landscape as I saw it or as I found it when I researched. I wanted people to know what was going on, especially under one of the most secretive governments in recent history. I wanted people to understand what some of the stakes were. This impacts the courts. It impacts education. In many provinces, there are all sorts of other issues, changing the nature of the public service. And it's up then for voters to decide what kind of country they want to live in, how much religiosity they want in their politics and government. It's not up to me as a journalist to make that pronouncement, but I would follow it with great interest, such a debate.
Excellent. Well, Marcy, thanks for joining us on Radio Freethinker, and best of luck with your future writing.
Thank you for having me.
Life is hard. The world is cold. You're always too young, and then too old. But we've changed all that. Escape from life at the new Waves on How concert series, where you're never too young or too old to rock out with Vancouver's most amazing bands each Friday and Saturday night from 8 p.m. till midnight. Sponsored by Covenant House. Come enjoy the show and donate to Covenant House's Street Youth Services Program. Join the Waves on How Facebook group for all the info. Waves on How is not responsible for smiling, laughing, singing, dancing, or sudden outbursts of complete happiness that may be caused by the Waves on How concert series.
Hello and welcome back to Radio Free Thinker. Our thanks to Marcy McDonald, and she gave a very interesting talk a couple days ago here in Vancouver about her book, The Armageddon Factor. Who's read the book, actually? Just, yeah, okay. all the hands went up.
we're all so depressed here now, though.
Yeah.
I mean, praise the Lord and pass the ammo. It's happening in the United States now, but maybe our next election will be happening here.
Well, I think it's perhaps, I mean, Marcy said that she's not the one to issue any calls to action, but I think certainly we are. And, you know, I think that we have to take a firm stand on, you know, do we want a theocracy here in Canada?
The answer is no. Just a minor point. I thought the one thing about her speech, because I was there and saw it, and she said, oh, I'm just reporting the information and I'm not going to tell you what to do. But, I mean, it's like someone, like a doctor going there says, oh, you've got cancer and you're going to be dying soon, but I'm just telling you this, and then walking away. I mean, I don't know. I understand she's trying to maintain a certain amount of journalistic distance, but there comes a point when I have to sit back and say, well, I mean, you reported this, and you said this is a bad thing, it's a horrible thing.
And when it comes, she didn't actually say it's a bad, horrible thing, though. She was quite neutral. I mean,
the
name,
the Armageddon Factor, it sort of sounds...
Well, it sounds bad, but I mean, that's...
It's a catchy title. I mean,
and I mean, in her talk, she was talking about how the Christian lobbyists were having all this bad influence on them and how they were... I mean, I did a blog post a while ago about the Gaza Strip, the Gaza Flotilla, whatever, and I tried to be neutral on it, but I had someone comment, said, you know, in the end, you said it's up to you to make its choice, but after everything you said, obviously you're pointing in one direction. And I mean, she was. She was pointing in one direction. She sees this as a negative thing in our society and a negative aspect, especially when she compares it to the Tea Party in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Right, certainly. But I mean, I think, though, that honestly, if you look at what she actually wrote, she's basically just repeating what the religious right have been saying. She's not going out of her way to make them look more ridiculous than they already are. They're saying all these things that the world's going to end soon and that Canada was prophesied in the Old Testament to do something in the end times. That's, like, they say that. She's just repeating it. I mean, as to the title of the Armageddon Factor, I mean, again, they believe Armageddon is coming, like, in the next 5 years. They think that Obama is, you know, a big player in the Armageddon. This is the mental process.
I like the fact that Canada is a big thing. That the reason why we're a dominion, that wasn't accidental. We were a dominion because it was prophesied from sea to sea, from the ends of the earth. You know, I loved when she said that part. I'm just going, you know, it's amazing what you can pull out of things.
Well, I mean, and it's winning people over, which is the scary part.
I think one of the things that scares me so much about this is I sort of feel that religion has not been a big topic in Canadian politics, and I'm worried that even though it's good to discuss the fact that the Christian right in Canada is just as insane as the Christian right in the United States, the fact that this is going to become a political issue that we discuss bothers me. Like,
well, I mean, it's not terribly out of character. I mean, we have had discussions like this in the past. They haven't quite reached this point, I don't think. But I mean, keep in mind though that that the effect of bringing in religion into the political arena has been felt, for a while now. I mean, you remember when Gary Goodyear first came out and said, "Oh, by the way, you know, the Earth was created so many years ago, and you know, evolution is just a theory, and potentially gravity as well." Like this is not anything like new. It's not like a secret. We've known this for like 5, 6, 7 years.
I think one of the interesting things too that she brought out that I hadn't really thought about is I mean, we think of the Christian fundamentalist, but part of that is she's saying it's actually religious fundamentalism in one way. I mean, the Christians are the most active, but she made a point that that the ethnic communities that are coming in, and a lot of them are not Christian. I mean, they're Muslim, they're Hindu or whatever, but they're still fundamentalist in their religious beliefs. And I worry about things like religious law. I mean, there was a tempering in Sharia law in Ontario, right? And the idea of making it blasphemy illegal or something like that, where you can get a sort of cross-religious consensus, but it's all sort of fundamentalist. I think that might be the uniqueness of Canada, is the fact that we'll have a fundamentalist, but it'll be more of a pure religious fundamentalist than strictly a Christian one like you get in the States.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and you also got to keep in mind that as we mentioned in the interview, Canada doesn't have on the books secularist laws. We're already kind of a theocracy if you really sort of follow the chain back up to the Queen of England.
Well, and one of the things that I found really, really annoying, this is a historical note, and you're probably aware of it, Ethan, is that when we repatriated our Constitution in 82, the Conservatives had put in there that Canada was created as under God. I can't exactly remember the quote.
No, that's the U.S. Never mind.
Right, but no, it was created as under God. And actually, I remember Sven Robertson, who was the NDP at the time, quit the Constitutional Committee because that aspect was put into it. So even in our Constitution, we are seen as a God-given type country, which really is annoying for any of us who are rational.
Yeah, or who don't believe in a God. Maybe you believe in, like, you know, the Greek pantheon. That's annoying. Well, we're kind of running out of time here on Radio Free Thinker, so we should go into our skeptical highlights. You know what's interesting? It's November now.
It is.
On November...
Are you guys growing your mustaches? It's November. Sorry.
I already have one.
You are.
November 9th is Carl Sagan Day. He would have been 76 years old this month, if he was still here.
Are we sacrificing a lamb to his...
No, because that'd be stupid.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Listen to the his pale blue dot speech in his name.
Sure. Or
alternatively, the Symphony of Science auto-tune version of his dialogue.
You can do that as well. Or, in fact, a lot of skeptic and humanist groups all over the place are putting on special events themed around Carl Sagan. They're screening Cosmos. Here in Vancouver, we're actually going to be reading Contact for the CFI Book Club, and that's so Saturday, November 13th at 1 p.m. at the Grindin Gallery Coffee Bar on Main Street. As always, come by. Please have read or releasing the movie, and discuss Contact with us. But as I was saying, skeptical groups all over. In fact, in, I believe, Florida, they're having a big event. James Randi is going to be speaking. It's going to be quite the to-do, I'm sure. I think Andrianne is going to be there as well. So I think it's just a really cool thing, and I encourage you that if you have some skeptic, curious friends, you know, Carl Sagan's a pretty good place to start. So I encourage you to try it out.
No, no offense there, but, you know, Skeptic Curious, and it's being held at the Grindin Gallery. Is this some kind of porn thing? I'm sorry. When you said the Grindin Gallery, I had visions.
Well, I think grind is because when you grind coffee.
Oh, and then you have a gallery so that you can have a picture of the coffee? I don't know. I think, though, if you're Skeptic Curious, it's worth it either way.
Sure, fine, whatever.
I've got an event coming up tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the Vancouver Public Library. It's called The Trouble with Billionaires. It's a talk put on, actually, I believe it's a book launch, put on by Linda McQuaid and Nils Brooks, where they're going to discuss the damage of extreme wealth causes to equality and the healthy functioning of society.
And I have a UBC Freethinkers event coming up this Thursday, November 4th. It starts at 7 until whenever you want to stay. It's the UBC Freethinkers game night, so hang out. There'll be some free food if you're a member or you pay $2 to get in. So yeah, come hang out with us. And that's at Irving K. Barber Learning Center, room 158.
Where is that again?
It's on campus. For anyone who's wondering.
Sorry, what?
When is that again?
This Thursday.
This Thursday.
At 7.
Well, you know, coming up later this month, of course, the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast is visiting Vancouver. If you haven't purchased your tickets already, you should do so, like, right now, because we're running out. The reception is now sold out. No more tickets are left. We have some of the general admission, so please hurry, get your tickets. You can find out all the information at www.cficanada.ca/Vancouver. And again, come and ask them some questions. What is up with the mummies and cancer?
Exactly. And I have a... Yeah, no, I don't have anything. Are we gone?
No, we're still here.
Oh, okay.
I'm still here.
I got my tickets. You got to take... I assume you have to have a ticket.
Well, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And just a reminder to everyone, please check out our webpage, www.radiofreethinker.com, and you can follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT, and you can get all our tweets, which I think is very interesting. So that's it for today's show. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian and Executive Director of CFI Vancouver, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Chloe saying come to games night on Thursday.
And this is Daniel. Chloe just said what I was going to say.
I'm sorry.
So that's awful, Chloe.
I know.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.